there's education, and then there's hyper-education.
Parents are saying, my kids may be doing all right in a fine school, but I want them to get even more educated. I want them to be ahead of the curve. It's a growing trend that is causing some concerns among educators and parents and even kids, which that's what I'm referring to as hyper-education.
That's Pawan Dhingra. We talk with him about his book, Hyper-Education, Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. It's an up-close look at the education arms race of after-school learning and academic competitions. Then we hear about a remarkable journey to racial truth and reconciliation, undertaken by two Americans, one black and one white. We talk with J. Chester Johnson about his book Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre, and A Story of Reconciliation. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Beyond soccer leagues, music camps, and drama lessons, today's youth are in an education arms race that begins in elementary school. That's what my guest, Pawan Dhingra, says in his book, Hyper-Education. He uncovers the growing world of high-achievement education and the after-school learning centers, spelling bees, and math competitions that it spawned. It's a world where enrichment centers like Cumann have seen a doubling of growth since 2002 and the targeting of children as young as three. Dhingra shows why good schools, good grades, and good behavior are seen as not enough for high-achieving students and their parents, and why the education arms race is likely to continue to expand with some high costs to kids, families, and public education. Pawan Dhingra is professor of American Studies at Amherst College. Pawan Dhingra, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
This book, Hyper-Education, first of all, tell us, what is hyper-education?
So there's a growing trend in much throughout the country of families with young kids, let's say elementary school age, who are in fine schools and the kids are doing just fine in school. Yeah, the parents want more education for them after school, whether that is, you know, learning centers that are for profit and charge a monthly fee or academic competitions. In other words, parents are saying, my kids may be doing all right in a fine school, but I want them to get even more educated. I want them to be ahead of the curve. And this is not something that is limited to one ethnic group or one geographic setting. It's a growing trend that is causing some concerns among educators and parents and even kids, which that's what I'm referring to as hyper-education.
And you start this book with a spelling bee, but it's not the famous Scripps spelling bee. Why do you start there?
Yeah, so spelling bees is one of the sites of hyper-education, as are other academic competitions, but I focus in part on spelling bees because it's something that gets a lot of attention. Scripps spelling bee is a national event. It's broadcast on ESPN, and kids love it. And it's gotten to be associated with Indian American community because a lot of the winners have been Indian Americans. So I start with an anecdote of Indian Americans in a spelling bee that's actually not the Scripps spelling bee, but it's just for Indian American kids. And it's a sign of how certain academic interests have really mushroomed in certain communities, even as this trend is national and goes beyond one ethnic group. It's kind of a highlight of a trend that's going on.
Yeah. And, you know, before we get into kind of the more general phenomenon, I'd like to talk just a little bit about the Indian American community and maybe the Asian American community in particular, because you do make some important points about this group of parents who focus on doing this kind of learning programs with their kids. What is motivating them?
That's a great question. So yeah, the book does focus some on this because so much of our conversation around families who seem, quote unquote, too eager for education surrounds the Asian American community. The whole tiger mom stereotype is a great example of this. And I wanted to talk to parents who actually fit that stereotype, as opposed to just talking about them in the third person and understand what's motivating them, because they're often the ones who are critiqued for putting too much pressure on education and hurting their kids and other kids. And so what's motivating them has a lot to do with a sense of, as immigrants, they're quite worried about their kids' abilities to, you know, feel academically and then long-term, like economically secure. And so they think that education and doubling down on education becomes the most safest route to help their kids achieve and overcome barriers that they may face, whether barriers be racial, whether those barriers be a lack of familiarity with the culture as immigrants, whether it be we don't have many social networks here, we really don't know who to ask to help my kid get an internship, that kind of thing, which many people rely on. And so for our kids to do well, they have to be more educated and achieve at higher levels than other kids do. Otherwise, they won't get noticed, and otherwise, they won't have opportunities. That's a lot of what's motivating them, a sense of insecurity around their place in the country as immigrants and as minorities. And they themselves, the parents who I'm referring to, often themselves are highly educated through this kind of hyper-education experience back in their countries of origin. And so the idea of having your child in an after-school learning center doesn't seem strange, because if you yourself, you know, are familiar with it or know people who have done it.
In this book, Hyper-Education, Pavan Dhingra, you do talk about the impact on inequality, on disparities in education that these kinds of learning programs entail. First of all, talk about that issue, talk about that problem, and then what is the remedy?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm really glad you highlighted this, because one of the core themes of the book is that these are well-meaning parents who want the best for their kids and who feel that, you know, unless they do this kind of hyper-education, that their kids could be at a disadvantage. And yet, one of the unintended consequences is that by pursuing hyper-education in these for-profit venues or through academic competitions, which themselves can cost a good amount of money to really prepare for, they inadvertently reproduce and worsen class inequalities between those who have the resources for this hyper-education and those who don't. And so educational gaps grow between those who have the access to tutoring, extra attention from instructors, resources like learning materials they buy online, coaches to prepare, help them in for academic competitions, compared to the kids who don't have access to this, or their resources are being put into other venues that they think are more necessary. And so this is, and along with this kind of class inequality in terms of educational achievement that can come through hyper-education, there's also increased stress and anxiety that teachers and other educators are seeing among kids. And so I spoke to a lot of teachers and educators for this book who really worry about the emotional and mental health of young children. So like right now, it's relatively known that high school can be a very stressful place for kids, and mental health among high school students is a real concern. But even middle school and elementary school students are experiencing increased levels of stress and anxiety, in part because of heightened academic expectations. And so the more that parents pursue this for their kids, again, with best intentions in mind, the more they reaffirm the idea that if you don't achieve in school, then you're really in danger of some, you know, negative outcomes, right? Whatever those might be specifically. So kids are under more pressure. So there's a lot of negative consequences of this hyper-education. Again, even though the parents are just looking out for what they think is the best interest of their kids.
And you call it an education arms race, which affects even children who are not attending these kinds of right. programs.
Yeah, I spoke with parents. This is actually a really key point of why I got interested in the book as well, in this topic, because a lot of parents aren't doing this, obviously. And so they may say, well, what does this have to do with me? This isn't my kid or my family. But in fact, those are often the kids who aren't doing this who are most impacted, because if their classmates are engaged in some kind of hyper-education, then that raises the bar in the class and in the school of what it means to be really academically, excellent or upper level. And then other kids feel pressure to match that and therefore want to or seek out hyper education themselves, or they feel inadequate and they worry about their own opportunities and chances and their own intelligence and cognitive abilities. And so stress and anxiety are kind of all over the school. In fact, one educator said she sees what she calls, quote, academic bullying, which is the sense that if unless you're really doing well and getting all these advanced classes and accolades, then you're not smart. You're not good at something. So kids who are perfectly fine in a subject don't have the confidence that they should have because other kids are just outperforming them. And this is where the education arms race really comes into play, because some parents will say, well, you know, if other kids in my school district are doing this, then my kid needs to also just to keep up. And it becomes a domino effect that a lot of parents are really worried about. There's movements across school districts. You know, one of them is called Take Childhood Back, and a lot of other pressures to limit homework and limit expectations on kids because the stress and the concerns of outcompeting one another are so severe. And hyper-education is a key ingredient to all this.
Yeah, and you say that it's engendering, you know, pushback from parents and teachers, even unto white flight from suburbs.
Right. So this has been a growing trend as well for a long time, and you know, for over a decade, where we normally think of white flight. The idea is like, you know, white families in the cities leaving to go to suburbs because they don't want their kids to be with African-American kids who are integrating into schools. But this new white flight is of white parents. In the original white flight is the school will be lower quality, my kid won't learn as much. But the new white flight is not about that. The new white flight is leaving areas where there's a lot of hyper-education going on, maybe by Asian-American families, as I was referring to earlier. And they want, and parents want to go into school districts that are less intense. So they're not leaving school because the school's not good enough, not academically high enough, it's that it's too high in its expectations and in its norms. And so families who aren't leaving town to go to a different school district could either be, you know, going in a private school. And I've talked to private school admissions officers who say they're seeing more and more applicants from families who just want a less intense school environment, which is, again, typically we think of private schools as something people turn to because they want higher academic standards, and that's increasingly not the case. Or the parents will, you know, double down on hyper-education themselves because they want it, they have the ability to keep up with what's going on around them.
Let's talk now about the quality of the kind of learning and education that is being given in these programs, because you know, I sent my son, who is now in his 40s, but I sent him when he was a kid to a Waldorf school. He knew how to read earlier than most. They don't even begin teaching people how to read, kids how to read, until they're 7 years old. And yet these children, you know, when he graduated from that school in eighth grade, I mean, those kids went on to some of the best high schools and did quite well. So I wonder if you could talk about, first of all, what kind of education is being given and what is the quality of it? And what about the long-term quality of these two opposite, let's say, forms of approach to education?
That's a great example of an alternative education program at the Waldorf School. And it kind of demonstrates, right, there's no one way to educate a child. There's no right way, right? And then there could be, you know, there are ways that we know are, you know, lead to certain kind of positive outcomes and those who lead to some negative outcomes. But there's no just one recipe for how a child should be educated. The Waldorf pedagogy is very different than Center Public School, and especially this kind of hyper-education approach, which is all about giving, you know, more academic content at a younger age, as opposed to, as you said, like waiting until age 7 to learn how to read. And so the hyper-education outcomes, those who kids who experience hyper-education, and I talked to a lot of kids who are in the experience now and who kind of were in, you know, academic competitions or other forms of hyper-education earlier in their ages. And there's no like real major problems that these kids have. It's not a story of kids who are so pressured and they end up becoming, you know, having breakdowns and resentments. No, that's not the story. The story is mostly of kids who, you know, felt like they were really busy at a younger age, but who, you know, can appreciate much of what they learned and still thought they had enough free time. And so the concerns that kids have the resentments aren't towards their parents for how they were educated. Instead, they sometimes wish that they were more accepted in their schools because, you know, when you're, you know, considered to be academically high achieving, the school system, ironically, may not be the most welcoming place, where even teachers, according to the youth, can make the students feel awkward for how much they learn, how much they know, right? So the concerns of the students who have gone through this, yeah, some of them kind of wish they had more free time, and but it's not a story of hating their upbringing and thinking their parents were too strict. It's more they can appreciate what they learn and kind of wish their school system was more welcoming also.
Well, that's interesting because maybe I misunderstood, but I thought you were saying in the book, in Hyper Education, Pavan Dhingra, that you were saying that, you know, often public school teachers are better trained than the teachers in these private learning academies, and that the private learning academy teaching can be rather rote.
Yeah, that's true, right. So the quality, how much the kids get out of these kind of tutoring centers is a separate question. Like, the kids themselves don't look back on it with regret. But a separate question and a meaningful question is what you're, I guess, what you're getting at now, which, yeah, how much do kids actually learn from tutoring from these centers? And I think the question is really an open question. Sometimes it can work quite well, but other times, you know, they're being taught in a way that really kind of reinforces short-term learning, isn't really inculcate a love of learning for the child. And educators see that. And some students will say that, you know, like, I'm doing it now more like a chore rather than something I'm really enjoying. And we don't want learning and education to become a chore. But those kids who stick with it, those kids who kind of find some pleasure in it and do it for the year, for multiple years, not just for 1 or 2 years, they typically have a much more positive relationship to their extracurricular academic pursuits. And so that's what I was referring to about the long-term implications.
Okay. Now, you have criticized the Gates Foundation for its approach to education reform. Tell us that critique.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation does a lot of wonderful things, and I'm not here to throw stones at them. But by their own admission, some of their efforts to reinvent schools have failed. For instance, they put a lot of money and time into creating smaller classrooms, thinking this was the best way to really advance learning. And, you know, they, years later, Bill Gates himself wrote that, you know, it didn't really have the effect that they thought it would. Then the emphasis went to teacher evaluation, teacher assessments, and some of the concerns and pushback around that has been that teachers feel that they're being undervalued, they're being given lack of authority, lack of autonomy, and overmanaged as a result. And so their enthusiasm for the job can go down, and their sense of how much they feel they're appreciated goes down. So there are, you know, there have been verified problematic consequences to some of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's work in education. And so when I wrote that piece, what I was referring to specifically was how during this COVID moment, which is really kind of making us rethink education in some positive ways, one of the concerns can be to kind of turn over our education system, which Governor Cuomo of New York, you know, hinted at, to Bill Gates and the foundation to help New York, quote, reinvent education, as Governor Cuomo said. And that may sound great because we have a lot of positive, you know, feelings and thoughts around Bill Gates and the foundation, but the track record is very mixed, and that should not be done. We should really listen to teachers more and how they think changes should be made in schools rather than Bill Gates himself per se.
Yeah, I mean, I was quite disturbed when Cuomo said that because of, you know, the COVID-19 is going to lead to us reimagining education. And a lot of us thought what he meant was a lot fewer teachers, a lot more online. I mean, this just seemed like a recipe for catastrophe. I'm not exactly sure what he means, but talk a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone knows what exactly that meant or what he wants to envision. But, you know, when he says he wants to hand it over to Bill Gates or have Bill Gates help lead it, then that opens up, well, what was Bill Gates' record on education? And it's a very mixed record. And I think also this remote learning that we're all kind of going through with our kids has led to even more interest in after-school education and is going to end up driving up hyper education, because a lot of parents are really worried about the COVID slide, as it's called, that students are learning less under remote learning, under remote education than they otherwise would. So parents are really anxious, and rightfully so, about how much will their kids get out of school. And so they have all the more motivation to seek supplemental learning outside of school. And so some of these tutoring companies like Kumon and Mathnasium and Sylvan and others are really kind of gearing up for online options and in-person options for kids and families who are worried about remote learning. In fact, they're marketing themselves as, you know, we can help solve the COVID slide and make sure your kid learns more than they otherwise would. And so this trend of hyper-education was already growing before COVID, and I think it's bound to take off even more so now.
And so what are your thoughts on about online learning? And is there a right way and a wrong way to do it?
Well, I mean, online learning is really, you know, it is a challenge, and it's hard for students to get as much out of it as they would in person. There's no question about that. I mean, a lot of evidence has shown that families without reliable internet, without quiet places to work, without some oversight by parents, are those students end up learning quite a bit less than they would. And there's really no clear solution. This is really a dilemma. I mean, it's hands down a dilemma around what to do. And so there's a lot of effort around maybe we should bring some students back in person. Those who are most prone to suffering the most under remote learning. But under remote learning, right, there are techniques and pedagogical aspects that parents can do in order to, teachers can do in order to help their kids, help the students grow and learn. But again, it won't be as robust as it would be in person. Not that in-person learning is always, you know, the most viable option either. Like if you're sitting 6 feet away from someone in a classroom and everyone's wearing a mask, and teachers are worried about masks coming, you know, falling off kids' faces, and they're always reminding kids, like, you know, put your mask back on, how much learning takes place in that kind of an environment, that's also an open question. So, you know, there's no one answer to this. It really comes down to how well can teachers engage students online, how much of a kid's home environment is geared and set up for adequate learning, what opportunities can be compensated for if that doesn't happen. These are all just really difficult questions, and I'm not going to pretend that I have all the answers to it.
And it will certainly take a whole lot more money going to schools.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, as I read your book, you do focus on younger kids. I had to keep on thinking about my granddaughter, who's 16. She's entering 11th grade, which is the most crucial year, I think, in terms of, you know, getting into a good college. And she's elected to go all remote. She's in New York City, you know, and just for whatever reason feels that she's going to have a better time learning by doing it remotely. But, you know, when this whole COVID thing first happened, I really encouraged her to take the time to, you know, explore her own interests. You know, here's an opportunity for you to find out what you'd really like to do, to take advantage of different learning opportunities that may make themselves felt to you. In other words, I thought it might be, you know, at a time which admittedly, you know, she's not getting the social emotional learning of being with her friends, perhaps she might get some more social emotional learning about herself.
And that sounds really, you know, wonderful and even idealistic, right? Like, wouldn't that be great if this catastrophe and this disaster of COVID could actually end up being a learning opportunity for some of us, and give us time to reflect, as you're saying. The problem, unfortunately, is that the conveyor belt of education doesn't pause. It may not run as smoothly as it would if we're all in person, but it's still running. And a lot of families, even those with, you know, second graders, fifth graders, feel that they are in a rat race around education, that they have to constantly be giving their kids a leg up, otherwise they'll kind of fall behind. And so when you're at 11th grade or 10th grade, or it sounds like a really nice opportunity to reflect, but unfortunately the way our system is set up around college admissions and how competitive it is, right, that there's very little opportunity for students to quote unquote take a break and reflect. Because if they do, the concern is that others will pass them by, right? Others will be doubling down as they prepare for an AP class or for a standardized test or for, or, you know, polishing their resume for an internship. And those are all the opportunities that, you know, the child who took a break won't have, and then will be at a disadvantage. And like I said, parents are not waiting until high school to be worried about these things. Mm-hmm. One after-school math teacher told me that if you're not doing after-school math in elementary school, then you're too late. Because if you're not doing elementary school, then you're not going to be really viable to get into an honors math class at your school in middle school. And if you don't do honors math in middle school, you won't be set up for honors options in high school, and then, you know, whatever else that might lead to. So this is the mentality in a lot of places. And so with that kind of mindset, the idea of taking a break and reflecting seems like a luxury many just don't entertain.
And finally, you call in this book, Hypereducation, you call for a new perspective on competitiveness. You know, I mean, some people have said the notion of childhood itself is at stake. I wonder if you could talk about, you know, what's the right way of approaching this whole issue?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that. And the book does spend a lot of time trying to explain like what we can do as opposed to just what the problems are. And part of this is we have to ask ourselves, especially in this moment right now that we're in, where, you know, we're under severe stress and with the virus, and realizing that, you know, we would get a lot further as a country if we had really, really focused on ideals and values like compassion for others, thinking about ourselves as part of a collective, not just part of a family or individual. And yet, are these the values that we're really instilling in kids in our schools and elsewhere? We may talk about them, but are we actively teaching them and assessing them? The school system can be, you know, I think the school system overall does a really great job. But we can think about what values and outcomes we want out of our school system. And that's where we have to really start. What is it we want out of school? What does it mean to be someone who is quote unquote educated? And what, you know, is that just being able to do well on, you know, standardized tests? Or is it something more well-rounded than that? Hopefully it is, especially as we're learning right now. And so that's where I want all of us to start. What do we want out of education? What do we think an educated person should be like? And then think about how we build a school system that furthers that. And I think that throughout the process, we really need to be listening again to teachers, because they're the ones who, despite being the ones we pay and give our kids to learn from, somehow we devalue their voices as we talk about what school should be, which I find sadly ironic. So I think that's somewhere to start. What do we want out of education? What kind of values we're trying to instill, and how are teachers partners in this? And they should be brought in from the ground up.
Well, thank you so much, Pavan Dhingra, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about your book, Hypereducation, Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough.
Thank you so much.
Pavan Dhingra. He's professor of American Studies at Amherst College. He's the author of many books, and his work has been featured in the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and elsewhere. Next up, the grandson of a KKK member who helped perpetrate one of the biggest massacres of black people in American history comes to terms with his damaged heritage. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. They're free. And you can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. The 1919 Elaine Race Massacre saw between 100 and 200 black Americans murdered. It was possibly the worst such massacre in our nation's history. But history almost forgot it. For my guest J. Chester Johnson, that history was also family history, something he discovered to his shock in 2008. He learned that his beloved grandfather, who raised him, had been a perpetrator in that massacre. As Johnson began researching the story more deeply, he met Sheila Walker, a descendant of black victims of the massacre. Together, she and Johnson committed themselves to a journey of truth and racial reconciliation, and an abiding friendship ensued. Johnson tells the story of the massacre and the journey of reconciliation its descendants undertook in his book Damaged Heritage. J. Chester Johnson is an acclaimed poet, essayist, and translator. J. Chester Johnson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very excited about being here.
So now to the book, Damaged Heritage. What do you mean by that title, Damaged Heritage?
Damaged heritage is really an essential part of American white racism. It's it really is the evidence that's passed on from one generation to another of this ingrained prejudicial traditions, customs, which are sometimes they're codified into law, and historically. It's really combined with that gratuitous and not infrequent and even sometimes severe violence and repression that's perpetrated by American whites against African Americans. And that's how I look upon damaged heritage. And of course, it played an important role in the development of this book because I won't fast forward, but you know, my maternal grandfather, with whom I was very close, who actually rescued me when my father died when I was one, and he looked after me. And yet I found out that he participated in this massacre. And there are not really individual incidences that create this damaged heritage. It is the accumulation of so much, although an event like that where you find someone that you cared about so much and he cared so much about me that you find that he participated in this terrible moment in history, and it really, you know, offended my personal conscience. And so I think that's where I am.
And so, you know, for you, damaged heritage is both personal, but you really do speak about it in much more general and societal terms in this book. I mean, this is a fascinating look, well, first of all, at this massacre and its import in American history, also a process of truth and reconciliation, as we will come to in your conversation with Sheila Walker, whose ancestors were victims of this massacre, but also a real look at the whole history of racism in the United States and how we get out of it. So the Elaine massacre, it occurred in 1919. Briefly tell us what happened.
Well, when African Americans fought in the First World War for the United States, and many of them were decorated heroes in Europe, and they were accepted in many places in Europe. And when they came back to the shores of the United States, they expected to be treated differently, be treated with more fairness and equity than they had when they left the shores. Well, white America rose up, and it wasn't just in the South, but it rose up and said, that's not going to happen. And there were racial conflicts that broke out, particularly in the summer of 1919, from Arizona to the Northeast and many places in between. And the Mississippi River Delta was probably the worst place during that time. Now, the Elaine massacre occurred within Phillips County, Arkansas, which is right on the Mississippi River. It's part of the Mississippi River Delta. Very rich land for cotton growing. Cotton prices had jumped up at the end of World War I and afterwards. And these returning veterans stepped back into being sharecroppers, wanted to take advantage of that, of those prices. And yet they repeatedly were treated with below price for their cotton as they sold it to their to the white planters locally. So in turn, they hired an attorney from Little Rock to negotiate on behalf of. In addition, they decided to create the Hoopspur Lodge. Hoopspur is located just north by a couple of miles from Elaine, Arkansas. And on the evening of September the 30th, 1919, at the end of what was known as freedom, James Weldon Johnson termed it the Red Summer of 1919, they had begun the process of organizing themselves into part of a union. It was going to be the Hoopspur Lodge of the Progressive Farmers and Household Union, which had been created by a returning Black veteran who meant to organize Black sharecroppers throughout Southeast Arkansas. But this was just going to be the Hoopspur Lodge. About 100 African-American sharecroppers and their families were meeting along with the attorney from, or an attorney, Little Rock, and also the head of the union. And about 11 o'clock, Model T Ford drives up with the deputy sheriff for Phillips County inside, white, obviously, and then a security official of the Missouri Pacific Railroad, which was up to its eyeballs in this massacre. Actually, Missouri Pacific Railroad's where my maternal grandfather was employed. Anyway, these two men step out of the Model T Ford, and they start shooting into the church to try to disrupt the proceedings. Unbeknownst to them, the group had hired guards to protect the union as it was going through the creation of itself. And so these guards fired back, and the Missouri Pacific official, railroad official, was killed. The deputy sheriff was hit in the knee. He crawls to, there's a railroad runs right along Highway 44, which is close to this Hoopspur Church. And he makes it into the county seat, tells the sheriff about it, says it looks as though there's an insurrection that's occurring in Hoopspur, and we're going to have to do something. So the sheriff deputizes a whole bunch of white men and white farmers and plutocrats and that sort of thing. And the next morning, they go out and start shooting African-Americans in this Hoopspur community. However, two additional white men were killed in this engagement, and I actually believe they were killed by friendly fire because these posses were shooting over the sloughs and shooting into coppices and that sort of thing. But nonetheless, by that time, there had been, counting the night before, there were three whites who were killed. The sheriff calls the governor, says there's an insurrection going on in Phillips County. We need those federal troops that are in Little Rock. There was Camp Pike right outside of Little Rock. This was just, as I said, toward the end of, well, it was the very at the end of World War One, and these troops were authorized by the Woodrow Wilson administration, which everyone knows is a pretty racist administration, to attack, establish order, quote, in Phillips County against these African Americans. So for the following 4 days, there was this onslaught against African Americans, particularly in the area of Hoopspur and around Elaine. And as a result of studies the FBI did and the Justice Department soon after the conflict, or the onslaughts stopped, upwards of 60 to 80 African Americans were killed. And then the number killed on October the 1st in the morning by the posses. Plus, there were vigilantes who came in from Mississippi and from Tennessee and surrounding communities in Arkansas who would ad hoc kill African Americans, actually just out in the fields, and many not even knowing what had happened in Hoopspur. I have estimated, and along with some considerable research with other people, that more than 100 were killed, although there were affidavits submitted to the Supreme Court in a related case that suggest as many as, as hundreds of African Americans were killed. We'll never know, but my estimate is pretty conservative. When Bryan Stevenson's Equal Justice Initiative opened up the Lynching Museum and Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, about 18 months ago, they had the number at well over 200, because Elaine is obviously prominently featured there, because it was in fact the largest lynchings, killings, attacks on African Americans in our country's history.
And the aftermath was also pretty striking as well, striking and important. Tell us about Scipio Africanus Jones. You know, first of all, the sharecroppers, and there were a whole lot of people who survived the massacre who were then arrested for murder and sentenced to die. And then there was Scipio Africanus Jones. Tell us who he was and, you know, what happened with this case?
He's one of the most interesting, Scipio Africanus Jones, one of the most interesting Americans, I think, in history. He was reared and worked in Tulip, Arkansas, which is south of Little Rock, but made a decision. He learned how to read and decided he wanted to be an attorney. He became an attorney through the auspices of three white attorneys who taught him the law, et cetera, et cetera. He became a very prominent African-American attorney, and particularly focused on civil rights issues and protection of Black rights.
And he was born into slavery, I read, and was a sharecropper.
Exactly. That's exactly right. We don't know all the origins, but it looks as though that he was born when slavery was still in place, and it appears that his father was the owner of his mother. But anyway, that is sort of the beginnings of Scipio. He was a laborer early in his teenage years and that sort of thing. But then he goes to Little Rock and he goes to school and learns the law and becomes an attorney, becomes very respected. He was actually both on Blacks and Whites called him Judge. When the prosecution of, there were five whites who ultimately died in this massacre, there were 122 Blacks who were charged with various crimes, ranging from murder to night riding. Scipio got involved after the initial trials. I mean, there were some that, the juries would be out only 2 minutes, and many of the whites who actually participated in the killings served on juries. It was really a violation of equal justice under the law. Scipio focused his efforts, while he focused on all 74 who were convicted of crimes ranging from first degree murder to night riding, but he focused on those that had been charged with first degree murder and were supposed to be summarily executed. There were 12, the famous Elaine 12. Of that 12, there were six, and I won't go through the legal jargon and all that, why they were chosen, but it was a group called the Moore Six of that 12. And Scipio used their case, Scipio and the NAACP, to appeal to the Supreme Court in a case called Moore versus Dempsey. This event, the massacre was in 1919. In 1923, Scipio writes the brief. He can't argue, it was those times throughout the country. He didn't argue the case before the Supreme Court. A Boston Brahmin attorney actually did that. And there was in the case for the appellants, one, and it's called Moore versus Dempsey, with the opinion written by Oliver Wendell Holmes. It was the very first time since the passage of the 14th Amendment, which, if you recall, 14th Amendment is equal protection under the law. But the Supreme Court from 1868 until 1923 had determined that states themselves had the right to determine what the civil rights were for the individuals within those particular states, which obviously contributed to Jim Crow. But there had been, as I initially discussed, there had been all these racial outbreaks throughout the country around that time. For example, the week before the case was heard in the Supreme Court, Rosewood broke out in Florida, which was sort of a mini version of Elaine. And Oliver Wendell Holmes particularly felt that something should be done, that there we had to do something as a nation to stop these racial conflicts. So by a 6-2 opinion, and Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the opinion, it was determined that the federal government, more specifically the federal courts, could intervene when there were some gross injustices in local and state legal proceedings, and that they could intercede on behalf of those who had been adversely affected by those local and state decisions. And this decision, Moore versus Dempsey, really gave body for the first time to the idea of legal protections, due process, and equal protection of the law. I actually believe, and I've written in the book, that I think that's really when the civil rights movement began to take hold. I mean, if you look at Brown versus the Board of Education decision, it is sprinkled with the issue of equal justice under the law. And this was the first time Moore versus Dempsey, and many scholars have looked at it from that point of view. There was a book that came out in 2014 called Civil Rights and the Making of the Modern American State. And it is totally focused on Moore versus Dempsey as an underlying element of civil rights movement of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So Scipio, as I say in my, I actually, he's one of three people I dedicate the book to, or to the memory of Scipio Africanus Jones. I think he will someday be known as the American hero he really is.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with J. Chester Johnson about his book, Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre, and A Story of Reconciliation. So your grandfather, Lonnie, who took such good care of you when your father died when you were 1 year old, he was so important in your life. He was with you all the time. How and when did you find out about his role in the massacre?
Well, in 1957, I was 13 years old, and Lonnie and his family had moved. When Lonnie participated in this massacre, obviously 1919, he was living in a place called McGee, Arkansas, and that was the hub, the Southeast Arkansas hub for the Missouri Pacific Railroad. He had been transferred close to 20 years later to Little Rock. And coincidentally, he was living only three blocks from Little Rock Central High School, he and Hetty. And after he died, my mother, who had brought my older brother and myself under the same roof much earlier in Monticello, Arkansas, a small town in Southeast Arkansas. And we used to go to Little Rock frequently. And during there was this federal-state constitutional crisis that occurred in the integration of Little Rock Central High School, where nine African-American students wanted to integrate the largest high school in Arkansas. And Faubus and Eisenhower had a major conflict. Eisenhower brought the 101st Airborne Division to make sure that the under federal rulings that the integration of Little Rock Central happened. But it caused a real uproar throughout the state, actually throughout the country. And there were many times that my mother and I had opportunities to talk about race and that sort of thing, driving back in the 100 miles back and forth between Monticello and Little Rock. And she began to tell me about Lonnie's participation as a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And she talked about his having a sheet and hood and leaving at nights when they were in McGee. This is where she grew up. And then she told me a story about this, what she called a well-known race riot, and that he participated in it as an employee of the Missouri Pacific Railroad. Now, I didn't really have any place to hang that. I didn't, you know, from a historical perspective. So it was something I really didn't focus on substantially, although she talked about lots of African Americans dying and the cotton fields being an element of the killing fields, close to the railroad, close to a highway, and all of that. Fast forward, I'm asked as a writer in 2008 to write the Litany of Offense and Apology for the Episcopal Church for the National Day of Repentance, when the Episcopal Church formally apologized for its role in transatlantic slavery and related evils. And as I was doing my research, I came across a 70-page book written by the African-American historian Ida B. Wells. And she called this event the Arkansas Race Riot of 1919. And I read through it, and I was quite upset about it because I grew up a county removed from Phillips County, and I'd never heard about this event. And I just felt that there had been sort of abusive silence about it.
So you have described this book as one white Southerner's pilgrimage to achieve racial reconciliation. And you had a companion on this journey that was Sheila Walker, whose ancestors were, in fact, victims of this. I'd like to explore a little bit about how the two of you went through a process of truth and reconciliation. And do you have the book there with you?
Yes, I do.
So on page 41, I wonder if you could just read the paragraph that starts with "From a True Accounting," because you describe kind of the rules of conversation that you followed.
From a true accounting, we empowered our journey with the genuinely human as a steadfast election on which we depended. Without even articulating the steps that led us, Sheila and I readily resolved to treat each other in contradiction to those characteristics that were an unrestrained presence during the fall of 1919 in Phillips County, Arkansas, at the time of the white attacks and in the near-term aftermath of the massacre. We chose respect over degradation, goodwill over control, friendship over pressure, truth over mendacity, comity over manipulation, and compassion over torment. For a broader purpose, we also felt that our racial reconciliation, which moved rapidly to authentic friendship, also stood in sharp contrast to the surge of white nationalism and white preference that had gripped the country soon after the election of Donald J. Trump as president.
So you were doing this conversation within the context of, you know, the election of a white supremacist as our president. I was very interested in the exploration of the idea of forgiveness, because you say that the need for forgiveness is essential on the part of white people doing this work of taking responsibility for this damaged heritage of racism. Doesn't forgiveness put the onus on black people to forgive the evil deeds of whites? How is that part of white people taking responsibility?
Well, I'd like to step back for just a moment. White folks in the United States don't deal very well with forgiveness. We don't know how to deal with forgiveness in many respects. If you recall, when the Mother Emanuel AME church massacre occurred, 9 African Americans were killed a few years ago in Charleston, South Carolina, the relatives of the victims forgave Dylann Roof. And they did it publicly. the response by white folks was really one of astonishment. Why does this happen? How does this, you know, what happened? And, you know, white people haven't had the same kind of vulnerabilities that African Americans have. And they haven't also understood the power of forgiveness. And when I refer to that, it segues into the experience with Sheila. We began seeing each other and talking to each other in the fall, I mean, in the early part of calendar 2014. And we all sort of immediately knew that what we were doing with each other as friends, as progression occurred, we just developed friendship, that it was really a significant form of reconciliation. And it may have been only me, but I was really concerned about this image, this sort of shadow of Lonnie affecting this relationship. I feared, you know, that maybe, you know, because he was someone I loved, someone I adored, but at the same time, he was this gunman who participated in this terrible massacre and where she had a number of victims as part of this event. And in connection with that, we gave a symposium, four or five of us familiar with this, in New York City. And during that, Sheila publicly said, you know, I forgive Lonnie. I forgive Lonnie more than Chester has. And she discussed the reasons why that, you know, people are born good, but bad circumstances make good people do bad things. And from that moment on, it became clear that we had an ability to become closer as friends than would have been the case in the absence of that forgiveness. Now, speaking personally, I haven't gone as far as Sheila has. Maybe it's part of the white privilege that I've enjoyed and that I haven't seen the vulnerabilities. I've tried to understand the power of forgiveness, the way that it's been demonstrated certainly by a large number of African Americans. And I have, as you correctly pointed out, that I believe forgiveness by African Americans is an essential part for America to deal with racial reconciliation.
Why should the onus be on Black people? Why isn't it white people, an anti-racist program to their fellow white people, the thing that really is needed?
You know, I have that in mind as well. I mean, my view is that the onus is on the white folks to deal with this. I refer to the term genuinely human in that paragraph that you had me read. And that's really the first step. We collectively, white people, have to understand the importance that there is a commonality between human beings that exceeds any of these very minor differences that may exist in skin color, speech, accents, customs, traditions that white supremacists have used to divide African Americans from whites and to give justification for American white racism. That is what I'm saying about the acceptance of the genuinely human is exactly what that is, a necessary step for whites. I am just saying. And I had last night, Sheila had a birthday and party, and it was a Zoom birthday party, but she had family members, and we actually had a long discussion about this genuinely human and also the power of forgiveness. And it is clear that Blacks have been, in many ways, forced by their own humanity to forgive in ways that whites have not even thought about. But the forgiveness that I'm referring to in terms of what the impact on whites is the ability to accept forgiveness. We are so bad in terms of the area of forgiveness that even when we're given forgiveness, it is hard for us to accept it. I mean, part of what King referred to as a weapon of love, he was really talking about forgiveness. And yet, think about how few people really accepted that idea, particularly folks in Southeast Arkansas. And I only use that as sort of an example of the inability to accept forgiveness by African Americans. And I'm just referring to that as being a piece of the overall need. I put a whole, you know, I put a structure in that I truly believe can lead to a different outcome, that you know, we suffer from this. It's been 400 years. We suffer from this cycle of generation after generation. And what causes it? And it really is goes to this issue of damaged heritage and not the acceptance of the genuinely human. And because generations tend to I think that whites knew that what they were doing wrong over this period of 400 years, that what they were doing was wrong. But what happened is that they participated in the adoption of this excessive veneration of ancestors, past traditions, etc., that their grandparents, the parents, and that served to shadow, to inoculate, to camouflage, to excuse white supremacy, and for whites to take advantage economically as well as socially, and that in the absence of filial pietism, which is the excessive veneration of the past, they would not have been able to implement this damaged heritage. They could not confront what they were doing to African Americans without the ameliorative effects of filial pietism.
So in a way, what you're saying is that the need for forgiveness, tell me if I have this right, that white people, maybe it's more that white people need to ask for forgiveness in recognition of their having taken advantage of white privilege, from one extreme to the other of racism. Maybe more that might be the emphasis than that black people need to do anything in particular.
White people need to realize they cannot save themselves. They cannot, because of this, the magnitude of this inheritance, this damaged heritage. The generations where this has happened, there is inability. It is not possible, in my opinion, for whites to self-forgive, for whites to create self-redemption. Now, I didn't participate in the massacre. I'm not guilty of that. But what I did is it is in part of my inheritance. And if I don't deal with it, if I don't address it, then all I've done is forced it forward for recycling of racism. And you are exactly right. And I mean that in that context. Whites need to recognize that they need that forgiveness. In fact, we can only expect for us to be redeemed by those that we have made our victims. Those we have made our victims, which are black men, black women, over the course of the history of this country. And only by doing that, by recognizing that they alone can really free us from this cycle, Because we're not, the blacks aren't the only ones who are the victims. We are victims. It is whites are victims as well. And for us to break this cycle, we have to realize that the forgiveness of African Americans is essential for us because we can't do it ourselves.
Well, it's been really a privilege to talk with you, J. Chester Johnson, about this book, Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre, and A Story of Reconciliation. Thank you so much for joining us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
J. Chester Johnson. J. Chester Johnson is an acclaimed poet, essayist, and translator. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.